if they need an alternative route. It's wide enough to allow cars to cross, and I was just thinking it's been open for the past week during the Easter holidays. Phillips made a low, rumbling sound in his throat. It wouldn't make much sense for Edwards to have driven into Durham via the motorway, then to have gone across one bridge and through the tourist centre, just to cross back over another bridge to get to your cottage. He'd want to get in and out again, as quickly as possible. You're assuming he drove into Durham via the A690, Anu argued. What if he took a coastal route? Or, what if he came off the motorway earlier, then took the quieter ring road and circled into Durham from the east? If he came in that way, he would have to drive through the tourist center to get back to the right side of the city to visit my old cottage. With a new light in his eyes, Phillips turned back to the footage and began to search. I don't know what visibility will be like, he mumbled to himself. Aha. Here we go. This is the view overlooking Bribens Bridge. I only have it in one direction, but hopefully we'll catch something. They put their heads together again and watched the cars move with comically slow speed across the screen. Wait, Anna murmured, and pushed her nose to the screen. What's that? Phillips shook his head. I don't see. Why would anybody be driving with a sunshade down, at night? Anna tapped her index finger against the shape of a small SUV with both sunshades lowered as it passed across the 18th century, Stone Arch Bridge. I always said you were a good un, Phillips declared happily, and turned to bestow a smacking kiss on her cheek. Do you think it's him? I think you've got a bloody good nose for this business, he said. Because I'm damned if I know why anybody would keep a sunshade down at night unless they didn't want the cameras to pick up their face. Phillips zoomed into the image even further and could make out a pair of strong male hands on the steering wheel and some kind of dark jumper. He might not be able to see a face, but he could see a registration plate. Bingo. An hour into the interview, D.C. Lowerson could feel a light sweat breaking out beneath his impeccably pressed shirt and wondered why he had never noticed the lack of air conditioning before. Probably because no interview had ever seemed so vital, and the weight of expectation weighed heavily on his padded shoulders. A fraud inspector from Durham Area Command was seated to his left, wearing the slightly dull expression of one who would rather be back on his own home turf and had a habit of checking his watch with annoying frequency. Opposite him, a lanky man with a pinched expression and a gold pinky ring was scribbling notes in a pale blue legal notepad, while his client fidgeted in her seat beside him. Despite her obvious anxiety, Elaine Hoffman Smith was a stubborn woman. After nearly an hour of determined questioning, she remained adamant in her refusal to discuss any details of her relationship with Ear Edwards. That's privileged, she said, mulishly, for the 50th time. As I've told you, discussions between a legal professional and their client are subject to legal professional privilege. Lowerson could feel himself beginning to lose patience. The woman's career as a legal professional was already in tatters and she was being prosecuted separately for aiding and abetting criminal harassment alongside a string of unrelated fraud charges. Why didn't she make a clean breast of it and disclose what she knew? In the first place, professional privilege does not apply to communications which you knew constituted, or intended to constitute, a criminal offense, he said coldly and, behind the glass partition, Ryan smiled in approval. In the second place, privilege only applies to communications pursuant to litigation or where you have been asked to give advice. Lowerson tapped the top of a stack of papers. These email exchanges with Edwards, dated as recently as 2 weeks ago, don't have any connection with ongoing litigation, and they were not responding to a request for advice. Were they, Elaine? Her solicitor looked up from his notepad and fixed Loison with a patronizing stare. Detective, as you are well aware, my client has not been found guilty of any criminal offense relating to her former client, Ear Edwards. In this country, we prefer to allow the courts to determine guilt, and persons are presumed innocent until proven otherwise. It is quite clear from Ms. Hoffman-Smith's statement that she formed a genuine, if mistaken, belief that certain email communications were subject to legal privilege. Loison cut through the spiel. I'm not interested in her mistaken beliefs. I want to know why she thought it was acceptable to hand deliver threatening notes from a known serial killer to Detective Inspector Mackenzie's home address in the days leading up to her kidnap by the same man. There was an uncomfortable silence around the table. My client reiterates that she genuinely believed those messages to contain pertinent information relating to an offense. And she failed to pass it on to the police through the proper channels? Loison scoffed. Give me a break. The woman's face fell into worried lines and she darted a glance towards her solicitor, who took his cue and tried again. At worst, my client acted rashly, detective. He spread his hands. Hardly worth all of this fuss. Loison felt something snap and he leaned forward, every inch the man in charge. Fuss? He laughed shortly. Is that what you call a nationwide manhunt? Or the kidnap of a police officer? The attack on a man and his family? Fuss? He turned back to Elaine and pinned her with a hard stare. What did he tell you, Elaine? His voice lowered to almost a whisper, inviting her confidence. Did he tell you he'd changed, Elaine? That you were the woman who changed him? He caught a flicker in her eyes and knew that he'd stumbled onto the right track. Maybe he told you he loved you, Loison said, with a trace of sympathy he didn't feel whatsoever. Is that it, Elaine? When you visited him in prison, he told you all about his remorse. Or, better yet, did he tell you he was a wronged man? That it was all a terrible mistake? The woman flushed a dark shade of red and her lips trembled. That's right, Loison murmured, holding eye contact. Edwards told you he could never have harmed those women. That he was a doctor, a man who had devoted his life to saving others. One day, he vowed to clear his name. He just needed someone to believe him, to help him. Am I right? Her solicitor gave him another pitying look. Detective, do you have any relevant questions to ask, or are you planning on telling these fairy tales for the remainder of the interview? But Loison didn't look away. It isn't a fairy tale, is it, Elaine? You fell in love with Ear Edwards. She said nothing, but he caught the sheen of tears in her eyes. Listen to me, Elaine. He leaned forward to try to convey the importance of what he was about to say and took out a photograph of Mackenzie. This is Denise. She's 43 and a good person. She has people who love her and who desperately want her to come home. Please help us to bring her home. Elaine looked resolutely at the wall but, after a few humming seconds, her eyes strayed to the photograph. A woman not dissimilar to herself, she thought. You think he took her, she said, huskily. What if she ran away with him? At first, Loison thought he had misheard. Was this woman so deluded? But, Looking closely, he could see the telltale signs of jealousy. Unbelievable. He took a sip of water to give himself a few precious moments to consider his next words. Handled correctly, he might be able to use her emotions to their advantage. What makes you think that? Her solicitor interjected. I need a moment with my client. Why do you think she would have run away with him, Elaine? Loison overrode the interruption. The woman ran shaking hands through her hair and, under the gray, energy-saving light bulbs, her face was haggard. Elaine, the solicitor tried again to warn her, but she had reached tipping point. It was all in those love notes. She burst out, and spittle flew from her mouth in a perfect arch to land on the desk between them. To think I believed him. I delivered them to that bitch. Her hands were shaking now and she clasped them together in her lap. Loison frowned at her choice of words, thinking back to the sinister notes Mackenzie had found stuffed inside her letterbox and beneath the doormat. What makes you think they were love notes, Elaine? She bristled. I don't know for sure, but it's obvious that's what they must have been. You didn't read them? She shook her head. They. Her solicitor watched their defense go flying out of the window, set his pen to one side and resigned himself to professional embarrassment. Mr. Edwards wrote the notes while I was visiting him in prison. I brought the stationery with me and I took the notes away when I left. I never read them because he told me they contained details of someone the police should investigate, something he'd heard inside prison about the man you were looking for in connection to the graveyard killer. He said that, if he helped the police, they might agree to look at his case again. And you believed that? Tears began to fall. You never reported it. I trusted him, she said, as if that explained everything. Loison ran his tongue along his lower lip. What else did he ask you to do for him, apart from delivering these harassing notes? I wouldn't give him another thing, she shouted. No more phones, no more money. Nothing. Then Elaine was completely lost, crying loud, sniveling tears that ran through her mascara and smeared black tracks across her puffy face. At precisely 11 o'clock, Loison concluded the interview and rejoined his chief inspector in the observation room next door. Ryan said nothing at first but held out a cup of lukewarm coffee and waited until the man had taken a long gulp to quench his thirst. I'll make it a pint, after all of this is over. Loison nodded and rolled his shoulders. Was it all right? I could have pushed her harder at the end. Ryan took a swig of his own coffee and remembered Jack Loison on his first, stumbling days in Sid, compared with the self-assured detective standing before him today. Pride welled and he wondered fleetingly if he would feel a similar emotion one day as a father. He took another hasty slug of coffee, coughed as it promptly went down the wrong way, and dragged himself away from that worrying line of thought. Your handling of the interview was spot on. If you'd pushed any harder, she would have clammed up. I might have appealed to her better nature, he mused, tipping his head towards the woman being ushered from the interview room next door by her irate solicitor. But I would have been wrong. You were exactly right to prod her jealousy, because Edwards is her weakness. It sounds like she was completely taken in by him. Loison was relieved. I appreciate that, sir. I only wish I'd been able to get more out of her. Ryan gave him a keen look. We've got plenty, he said. For starters, we know who wrote those threatening notes, where they were written, and how they got to Mackenzie's door. That was a confession of guilt on her part, and it'll do her court case no good. That's true, Loison acknowledged. Then there's the small matter of providing Edwards with contraband while he was inside, Ryan gestured with his coffee cup. She brought him mobile phones and money, which helped him to escape and do God knows what else. What did you think about her claim that she wouldn't help him anymore, once she found out that he had run off with an attractive redhead? Loison stuck a hand in his pocket, unconsciously mirroring Ryan. I think that it still wouldn't rule out the possibility that she provided Edwards with a vehicle for him to pick up at the Stiford roundabout. He might have told her it was a getaway car for himself, in which case she was happy to provide it. Once she found out he'd used it to transport another woman, she doesn't see it as a kidnapping. No matter what we say, it would have been too late. Ryan crumpled his plastic cup and lobbed it into the bin in the corner of the room. I agree. There's still every possibility that Elaine Hoffman Smith drove a car up to that roundabout. There's only one vehicle registered under her name, and that's the one she's still using. But she could easily have picked up some old banger and left it up there for him to find. If only we knew the model, Loison replied. Toyota F4, late 2008 model in dark blue. Registration number SX080DW, Phillips pronounced, as Ryan and Loison entered the incident room. How the hell did you find it? Phillips leaned back in his chair and winked at Anna, who had her nose stuck in an enormous history textbook. Solid police work, he said, casually. Ryan wasn't fooled, but he decided to overlook any minor contraventions of strict police procedure in favor of calling an urgent briefing. All right, everybody, stop what you're doing and listen up. Anna had to admire the speed at which conversation died. We've had a breakthrough. I want you to focus all attention on locating a Toyota F4. He rattled off the registration and particulars. Last seen crossing Prebends Bridge in Durham. Ryan paused mid-sentence as one of the traffic analysts raised his hand. Well? He demanded. Sorry to interrupt, sir, but I think I've located the vehicle in question. Ryan's eyebrows flew into his hairline. And? A dark blue Toyota F4 with that registration plate was reported on the system after being impounded, sir. It was found parked obstructively across the entrance to the Copthorne Hotel late last night. Ryan's eyes flew to the map on the wall of the incident room and pinpointed the Copthorne, which stood on the bank of the River Tyne, on its bustling quayside. There were countless bars, clubs and restaurants in that area, but it was also within easy reach of the city center. He should know, since he used to live there. Did they locate the driver? The analyst shook his head. That's just it, sir. The registered owner is listed as a Mr. Reginald Farley, but he died more than 2 years ago and there's no record of any new owner. Ryan considered the information and felt his heart begin to pound. There was only one reason why Edwards would risk exposure by returning to the city, and that was to kill. He turned quickly to Phillips, who was already running a check on the missing persons database. A sickly feeling began to creep through his body, a foreboding of things to come. If we assume the driver of this Toyota was Ear Edwards, we know that he drove from Durham to Newcastle late last night. He dumped the Toyota across the entrance to a major hotel in what must have been a deliberate and calculated move to draw attention. He's peacocking again, Loison put in. Yes. What I want to know is where he went after dumping the car. Get me footage from every CCTV camera in the area. Frank? Phillips looked up from his computer screen and Ryan knew the answer before he had even asked the question. Tell me, he said shortly. Girl reported missing this morning, Phillips said softly. Bethany Finnegan, goes by Beth. 5'7" tall, long black hair. Ryan looked away and into Anna's dark eyes, which were full of understanding as she listened to the description of a woman who sounded remarkably like her. They both turned with crestfallen faces to hear the next part of the missing persons report, which Phillips read out in a low, monotonous voice. Beth is due to have a birthday next week. She'll be 16. Chapter 8. I'll never forgive myself. Those stark words hung in the air while Bethany Finnegan's mother continued to rock in the armchair of her sitting room, on the 12th floor of a high-rise block of flats overlooking St. James Park Football Stadium. Ryan and Phillips perched on a small sofa opposite, hands clasped between their knees. Long experience had taught them that there was no better way of speaking to the parents of children who were missing. It didn't help to sit or to stand, to accept a cup of tea or to use a certain tone of voice. It simply hurt to do it, and each time was as painful as the first. Ems Finnegan, Ryan began gently. The most helpful thing you can do is tell us exactly what happened yesterday, in the hours leading up to when you reported Beth missing this morning. Kelly Finnegan scrubbed the top of her hand beneath her nose, then dabbed at her eyes with the sleeve of her navy cardigan. She was still wearing yesterday's clothes and they could see the logo of a cleaning company on her crumpled polo shirt. Mid-length black hair was drawn away from her face in a neat ponytail, which had unraveled so that wisps of hair fell across her forehead. Her face was pale and devoid of makeup, except for the remnants of mascara which had long since been washed away by tears shed throughout the course of the morning. She sniffed loudly and Ryan reached inside his jacket pocket to offer her a small packet of tissues, which she accepted with shaking hands. Beth was a good baby, she said, staring off into the distance. I was 17 when I had her. She raised her chin, ready to fend off any judgmental comment that might follow, but Ryan and Phillips continued to listen with attentive, compassionate faces. Her father was just a lad from school. I knew it was stupid and he wouldn't stick around, but I didn't want to get rid of her. I wanted to keep her, right from the start. Her voice wobbled and she raised one of the tissues to her eyes to stem a fresh flow of tears. Like I said, she was a good baby. They nodded, letting her talk it out. Ryan had already skim-read the file and he knew that life had been hard for Kelly Finnegan. Long before she'd become a mother, she'd spent a childhood in care and had no family to speak of. Her juvenile history read like a textbook on shoplifting and petty crime, but, since the birth of her baby, he'd seen nothing but a solid track record of full-time, low-paid work that must have been back-breaking. Almost 16 years later, she worked her way up to the position of supervisor for a corporate cleaning company and she kept a tidy, polished home, even if it did belong to the state. On the main wall above the sofa there was a blown-up, framed image of Kelly and her daughter and Ryan assumed it had been taken in the soft focus light of a local photography studio. He was struck by how much older Beth looked than her 16 years and, taken together, mother and daughter could easily have been mistaken for sisters. "We're really close," Kelly sniffled, almost reading his thoughts. "We were always close, right from the start, and she told me everything. All about her friends at school, boyfriends, all the gossip, you know. She appealed to them and, dutifully, both men nodded. Did Beth tell you where she was going last night?" Her mother drew in a shaky breath and looked down at the tissue twisted in her hands. "She said that one of her friends, Emily Mallon, was having a party at her house. I know the family, so I said she could go. They live down in the rough end of Walker," but Kelly lifted her chin once again. "You can't judge people on where they live. They're a nice family." "We understand," Ryan murmured. "You felt confident about letting her go?" She nodded. "It's the Easter holidays, and to be honest, she was starting to climb the walls," Kelly confided. "They're back to college on Monday, but with a whole week to fill and me working most days, I worry about what they all get up to when they're bored." "Aye, that's kids for you," Phillips put in, and she smiled. "Beth is responsible. She wanted to make that clear from the start. She has 100% attendance at school and good grades. She doesn't get into trouble." She stopped and looked pointedly at both of them. "I suppose you know I was a bit of a tearaway?" Diplomatically, they remained silent. "Aye, well, things changed after Beth was born. Some people probably thought I was too strict, but I swore Beth would have a better life than me. She wouldn't have to worry about where the next meal was coming from or whether I would be coming home at night. I want her to finish school and get her A-levels. I don't care what she wants to be, so long as she works hard and gets her schooling." Phillips listened to her proud words and was transported back in time to 35 years ago, when his own mother had made a similar speech. "Frank," she'd said, "your father doesn't work 6 days a week at the factory for you to throw your life away. Now, you just think about it, my lad." "I trusted her," Kelly was saying. "I trusted Beth to tell me the truth about where she was going last night. I had a late shift at work, but she texted me all the way until about 10 o'clock. She told me the party was great and that she was planning to stay over at Emily's house." She fumbled around to find her mobile phone and hurriedly found the text exchanges. "Look, it's right here," she offered the phone to Ryan, with a look of appeal. "Maybe her phone is still working and you can find her that way." Ryan took a cursory glance down at the messages and saw that things were exactly as the woman had described. "That's what we're doing right now," he assured her. "We're liaising with the telephone company and they'll come back to us very soon." Kelly clutched the phone, clearly hoping it would ring. "And you'll tell me?" "Of course. You'll be the first to know, Ems Finnegan." But to return to events last night, Ryan steered her gently back to the facts. "You were telling us that Beth was supposed to be staying with her friend, Emily. She wasn't there, after all." The woman drew in a shuddering breath and looked across at the tall, good-looking man with the sad, serious gray eyes. She wondered what he thought of a woman like her. She wondered whether he heard the same old story every day, or whether he really cared. He seemed genuine, but you could never tell. "I couldn't get hold of her after 10 o'clock and I started to worry," she said dully. "I went straight to Emily's house after work and knocked on the door. What time was that? Ryan interjected. About 10:30. I thought that I could always use an excuse if it turned out everything was fine. But when I got there, Emily's mum told me she thought the girls were all here for the night. She gestured to the living room, so we knew straight away something was up and we rang around all the girls' houses. Turns out they were planning to stay at their other friend's house, Haley, she's called, after a night on the town. On the town? She rubbed at her eyes and felt her heart break. Fake ID, she said. Apparently, they all have it, but I never knew. I never thought that, Beth. Kids, Phillips said again. They're like moths to a flame. Tell them they can't do something, and that's exactly what they want to do. I thought that, she said. And that's why I let her have the odd glass of wine at home. I know they're only 15 or 16, she said defensively, but I felt better knowing that if they experimented with drink, they did it under my roof where I knew about it. A lot of parents feel the same, Ryan offered, as if he knew what he was talking about. What happened after that? I wasn't too worried, she said, voice muffled by the sodden tissue she held to her face. I thought Beth had snuck out for the night to have a bit of fun and she would come home with a hangover the next day. I knew she was with a group of friends and I know my daughter, Detective. She's normally so sensible. I was angrier about the fact she'd lied to me. Ryan swallowed and prepared to ask the next question. When did you become seriously concerned? I had a message from Emily's mum, joking about how Emily was in the doghouse for telling lies. She asked me how Beth was doing, but I couldn't answer because she still hadn't come home and she wasn't answering her phone. I was beside myself. I rang every one of her friends and then rang the police. What did her friends say? Speaking to the girls who had been with Beth the previous evening was next on Ryan's list, but it never hurt to get a story from all angles. They said Beth told them she was going to get in a cab and go home early. They were drunk themselves, so they left her to it. Kelly's lips shut so tightly they turned white at the edges. Em's Finnegan. She turned dazed eyes towards him and he knew that she was starting to shut down, so he asked the most important question as far as they were concerned. Did her friends remember seeing her with a man? Any man in particular? Kelly lifted shaking fingers to her temple as the ramifications of his question began to unfold. A man had recently escaped from prison. A serial killer who liked young, dark-haired women. Oh, God. My baby. A man? Yes. Snatched memories of conversations with her daughter's friends replayed in her mind and she tried to sort through her jumbled recollection. I think Emily said that she'd seen Beth talking to a man. She didn't say much, because, well, I'm her mother, she finished inadequately. Phillips made a note on his pad and circled it twice. Is it Dot, is it him? That man from the news? We don't know for sure that your daughter is missing, Ryan forced the words through stiff lips and felt like a fraud. We'll be searching for her. But let's not jump to any conclusions. Silent tears rolled down her face and his jaw clenched hard. What happens now? Her eyes darted between them, wide and searching. Ryan retrieved two small white cards from his pocket and handed them to her. These are my contact details and those of the family liaison officer, he explained. If you need to get in touch, if you remember anything important, call either one of us on these numbers. All right. She clutched the cards in a tight grasp and gave him another searching look. Something in his face must have reassured her because she seemed to relax against the back of her chair, finally giving in to the tiredness which laid claim to her body and mind. You'll find her. Won't you? Please, she added. Beth is all I have. Ryan did what he rarely did, and dropped to his haunches so that they were face to face. He rested his hand on top of hers, in a silent gesture of support. I'll find her, he promised, but he could promise nothing more. They spent half an hour rifling through the contents of Beth's bedroom but found nothing except the usual flotsam and jetsam of a teenage girl. With nitrile-gloved hands, they checked in all the usual, secretive crevices that a mother might overlook and still found nothing to suggest that Beth Finnegan had been groomed by Geir Edwards before his escape from prison. There were no letters stashed away, no suspicious, expensive gifts, and the girl hadn't owned a computer or a tablet. Faulkner's team of CSIs would likely go over the room again, but their instincts told them that, if Beth was indeed missing, she had not been complicit. They said their goodbyes and took the creaking lift down to the ground floor, inhaling the unfortunate scent of stale urine and marijuana as they went. Impressive woman, Phillips offered, as they stepped back out into the midday sunshine. Ryan kept stride with him as they headed back to his car, parked nearby. Yes, she was. Phillips caught the note in his voice. We'll find her, lad. Mark my words. Ryan stopped and raised his face to the sky, trying to clear the emotion swirling inside his head. A magpie swooped to land on the rusty green climbing frame of a children's play area up ahead, and he admired its colors, taking the time he needed to recover himself. The question isn't whether we'll find her, Frank. He wants us to find her so that we can admire his handiwork. The question is whether I'm going to be able to stand it when we do. Phillips tugged at his lip and wondered what he could possibly say, but Ryan beat him to it. I guess we'll find out the answer to that soon enough. With that, he stalked towards his car. Chapter 9. As a light afternoon drizzle began to fall, Mackenzie watched Edwards perform a series of semi-acrobatic moves from the window of her cell. She had ceased calling it a bedroom and had reverted to a more accurate description of the dingy box room that had now been her prison for over a week. Outside, Edwards completed a set of fast press-ups on the grass, then lifted a heavy log up and down in place of gym weights, pushing his muscles to the limit. He did the same thing every day, come rain or shine, and always with the same intense look of pleasure on his face. It was sickening. Last night had been a watershed moment for both of them. The sight of Edwards covered in human blood and wearing the same look of pleasure he wore now had brought horror, but also the understanding that an invisible seal had been broken. She was reminded of an old nature program on great white sharks, where David Attenborough had spoken in dulcet tones about the shark's ability to smell blood up to a quarter of a mile away and to detect one single drop of blood among a million drops of water. The thought of it seemed too fantastic to be true, but watching Edwards on the lawn outside, she was not so sure. There was an animal inside him, she thought. One so close to the surface that it took very little to break free from the constraints of ordinary, decent behavior. She had seen it in his eyes last night, more so than ever before. Mackenzie recognized that she was starting to change too. She felt like one of those caged animals you see at the zoo, and probably looked similar with her bare feet and unkempt hair to match the wild look in her eyes. Her body was constantly poised for battle, and when a fresh surge of adrenaline flushed through her, she paced the room like a tigress and would have sharpened her claws if she had any. Instead, she focused on mending her ankle. Her ribs would have to make do with the splint she had fashioned from thin wood and strapped against her midriff using the dirty covering from her mattress. She couldn't wear it when he was around, which admittedly could be at any time of the day or night, because the longer he believed her to be incapacitated, the greater the advantage she might have in the end. She rolled her ankle and winced. It was still tender following her escape attempt yesterday, and she had probably put back its healing process. For much of the day, she had forced herself to lie on the bed, using the upturned bucket as a stool to keep the ankle elevated. Hopefully, by tomorrow it would be good enough to use again. It would have to be. There was no other choice, she thought, watching Edwards dispassionately. She must try to find a way out. The animal had been given another taste of blood, and it wouldn't be long before he would go in search of his next kill. Bethany Finnegan was immediately classified as a high-risk missing person, and, after a short conversation with Chief Constable Morrison, it was decided that the investigation into her whereabouts would be managed by Ryan's existing task force because of the potential link to Operation Ireland. If Beth's body was found, it might provide a trail leading back to her killer, and they needed all the help they could get. Still, it did not remove the dirty, unspoken truth that, to find one woman, the police were relying on another having lost her life. Supposition and instinct played a disproportionately large role in their decision-making. However, the timing of her disappearance, Beth's physical attributes, and the fact that her behavior was so out of character were also strong factors in the escalation of her case. The Missing Persons Bureau acted as a national and international point of contact for all missing people and would usually be informed after 72 hours had passed, but Ryan took an executive decision and called them himself the same day. Meanwhile, Ryan's staff worked to trace the last movements of the Toyota RAV4 and its driver. Although they were swamped and understaffed, Faulkner spared two of his CSIs to go over the vehicle, which had been recovered from the entrance of the Copthorne Hotel and impounded on the premises of one of Sid's authorized contractors. Dave's Motors was a small but perfectly formed operation, nestled in a tin pot garage between two car rental giants less than 5 minutes' walk from the railway station in Newcastle. The yard was crammed with cars of varying shapes and sizes and in a range of conditions, but the Toyota had been given pride of place in the covered garage area. Not a soul but Dave himself had touched it before the CSIs arrived, and it took less than 2 hours for them to perform a thorough sweep of the vehicle. While they waited for further reports to trickle in, Ryan and Phillips spent their afternoon in the West End of Newcastle holding lengthy discussions with a series of distraught teenage girls, some of whom had overcome their distress at losing one of their friends to stare in frank admiration at the chief inspector and with considerably less interest at his beefy sergeant. Such behavior elicited embarrassed apologies from their parents and a degree of impatience from Ryan, who was in no mood to find humor in their aging hormones. "I need a drink," he fumed, once the last interview was concluded and they had returned to the safety of his car. Phillips rubbed at his chin to hide a smile. "Bit nervy, are we?" Ryan ran an agitated hand through his hair. "I'm sure I was never that bad," he said, emphatically. "I swear, when I was their age, I had more." "Decorum," Phillips said sweetly. "Respect for your elders?" "Yes," Ryan said. "Their friend is missing, dead, for all they know, and that kid in there. He jerked a thumb over his shoulder in the general direction of the house they had just left, spent half the bloody interview asking me whether I liked Coldplay and if I would come over and show her some self-defense moves. The cheek of it, Phillips chuckled. At least I was there to chaperone. I'm old enough to be her father. Nah, Phillips said. You're still the right side of 40, which makes you fair game. Ryan sent him a fulminating glare and then leaned his head back against the headrest, allowing the irritation to seep out of his system before he spoke again. Their stories essentially match, he said, feeling calmer than before. We've got four teenage girls, all of them underage drinkers wanting to go to the student night at Eddie's Beach Club, down on the quayside. Phillips unrolled a stick of nicotine gum and began to chew it rhythmically. That lass, Haley, seemed to be the leader of the pack. Pack. They all move in packs, Phillips said, sagely. Ryan held out a hand for the gum and shoved some in his mouth, irrespective of the fact he had never been a smoker, because Phillips was right. He was feeling downright nervy. Haley's parents weren't around last night, which is probably why the girls decided to use her house as a base for their little deception. The parents were, incidentally, out getting drunk themselves. Phillips made a sound like a harumph. What day is it? Tuesday, Ryan answered. I must be getting old. You and me both, son. Anyway, the girls headed straight to Eddie's, not long after the place opened. They managed to talk their way into the club using some fake IDs. Apparently, nobody remembers how they came by them, he added, with a roll of his eyes. But that's the least of our worries. Beth's best friend, Emily, says she remembers seeing her speaking to a really fit bloke at around 10:30. But she can't be sure of the time. About 20 or 30 minutes later, Beth told them she was going home early and would get in a taxi. That alone would ring alarm bells for me, Phillips said. What schoolgirl can afford a taxi home on her own? Ryan nodded. They were all too far gone by that stage to care. They waved her off and Emily thought that maybe Beth was heading off with the aforementioned really fit bloke. She couldn't say for certain it was Edwards, when we showed her his picture, Phillips cautioned. Ryan stared at the felt ceiling of his car. It was dark, she was drunk, and Edwards might have changed his appearance again, he said. Do you know what the worst of it is, Frank? The kid says that she wasn't worried about her friend heading off with him because he was well dressed and didn't look dodgy. Ryan propped his elbow against the window and leaned his head against his hand, only to be disturbed by the shrill of Phillips' mobile phone. They exchanged a look before he answered it, and everything changed. Phillips. Ryan heard the distant voice of Loison at the other end of the line, but couldn't make out what was said. They're absolutely sure? Ryan turned to Phillips with an inquiring look, which was ignored. This goes no further until I say so. Meet us there in 10 minutes. He risked a quick glance at Ryan, then away again. No, lad. Leave it to me. Phillips hung up and his mind worked quickly, thinking of how best to deliver the news he had just heard, while Ryan watched him with growing alarm. Spit it out, man. That was Loison, Phillips said finally, taking his time about returning the mobile phone to his inner breast pocket. Apparently, Beth Finnegan's mobile phone provider has pinpointed her last known location, down to a radius of 20 feet. Ryan began to smile, but Phillips hadn't finished. They say her phone is still switched on and transmitting, right now, from the same address. Well? Ryan began to reach for the ignition key. Tell me where we are headed. Phillips gathered the courage to look him in the eye, before delivering the final blow. It's your old apartment building at Wharf Square, down on the quayside. Chapter 10. Ryan declined Phillips' offer to drive and maneuvered through the streets of Newcastle as if in a trance. His eyes were open and his hands and feet went through the motions of operating the car, but he didn't respond to Phillips' quiet pleas to reconsider, and his face wore the ashen, shocked expression of someone who was reliving a nightmare. As they turned onto the quayside, Ryan no longer saw a spring afternoon in April, but the early hours of a summer morning in 2014. He visualized himself as he had been that morning, exhausted from another endless day searching for the hacker and begging for sleep. Phillips had driven him home to Wharf Square sometime after midnight, telling him to get some kip and start afresh the next day. His sister was staying with him and would probably be asleep already. Ironically, his parents thought that some company would be good for him, somebody to take his mind off work and help him out for a couple of weeks. But in all the hours he had labored, Ryan hadn't thought to protect what lay under his own roof, and he would live with the guilt for the rest of his life. Ryan. Phillips' sharp voice cut through the reverie, and Ryan slammed his foot on the brakes to prevent the car running through a red light. His hands clutched the steering wheel as he struggled to get his bearings, feeling lightheaded. Son. Phillips' gravelly voice was filled with concern. Pull over. Ryan gave a small shake of his head and put the car in gear as the lights changed again. You don't have to do this, Phillips tried again. I can tell Morrison it was too much of a conflict and you decided to step back. It's good sense, lad. I need to see her, Ryan said. There's always a chance. He tried to keep his mind focused on the road, until the courthouse appeared on their left. Its salmon pink brickwork had aged badly in the years since it was built, and it was fast becoming an eyesore compared with the glistening glass concert halls and classical townhouses surrounding it. The car slowed to a crawl as they passed, and Ryan remembered the day he had given evidence at Edward's trial, when he had recounted every hideous detail of his sister's murder so that 12 jurors could agree that her killer deserved to be locked away from the world. He saw their faces in his mind's eye, with their eyes downcast so that they wouldn't have to look at him while they listened to the unpalatable truth he had to tell. Ryan remembered the look of denial on their faces, the same disbelief he had seen earlier today in the innocent eyes of a teenage girl. Not Dr. Edwards, they thought. Not him. For it was only sinister-looking individuals who murdered people in the movies, not well-dressed, well-spoken men from the right background who saved lives at the hospital. It wasn't possible, they thought, even when faced with overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Thankfully, justice had prevailed, and Ryan remembered how he had felt after it was all over, stumbling down the steps outside the courthouse and through the crowd of reporters, running until he found somewhere to expel the acid rolling inside his gut. Behind him, a car honked its horn and he snapped back to the present, urging his car the remaining distance until they arrived outside a smart, glass-fronted apartment building overlooking the river. It looked innocuous, just another quietly expensive block on the redeveloped waterfront with bars and coffee shops surrounding it, appealing to the young professionals who lived there. But then Ryan noticed DC Lowison standing beside a team of CSIs, already suited and ready to enter the building, and he knew that history was repeating itself. Ryan parked in his allocated space in the residence car park at Wharf Square and switched off the engine. He looked up at the apartment building with bewildered eyes and wondered how it was that he felt so much a stranger here, when he had lived on the top floor apartment for nearly 3 years, not counting the last two he had spent with Anu at her cottage. Then he remembered that was gone too. "I can take care of things," Phillips said, urgently. "It doesn't take three murder detectives to go over a scene. If that girl is lying dead in my apartment, I have to ask myself how she got there," Ryan said, in a voice so quiet that Phillips struggled to hear him. "If, and only if, we find Beth Finnegan upstairs, it's because that maniac killed her." "You had nothing to do with it," he replied. Ryan continued to stare out of the window. "Edwards must have found the spare set of keys," he said to himself. "I left them in the drawer at the cottage. He must have found them before he set the place on fire." "So what if you did?" It wasn't an invitation for him to drive up here and help himself. "Don't you get it?" Ryan demanded. "He brought that girl here so that I would find her, so that I would see how fucking brilliant he is. Why did he do it? To prove that he's better, stronger. And killing some helpless young lass proves that, does it? The man's a raging nutter. There's no reason behind his actions." "I disagree," Ryan said, blinking a couple of times to shake off the hazy feeling clouding his head. "What Edwards really wants is another shot at finishing what he started the last time we were inside that apartment," Ryan continued. "This time, he doesn't want to lose, he wants to win. He wants to see me beaten and preferably dead on the floor at his feet. But he doesn't want to make it easy." "Oh no," he laughed shortly. "He wants to draw it out, to drag me down inch by inch until we're on a level." Phillips swallowed a hard lump in his throat, wishing he could wipe away the hurt and the grief. "If he's killed that girl,